fear is sometimes a very dangerous thing to do. You know, we're a small profession, but we happen to love it. And really, the only reason I'm here, years ago I learned the word buck. Then I found out 5 years ago it had two definitions. Those of you who've been in Southeast Asia will know the second. But a buff is a person who gets interested in some part of history for some reason or another, and he pursues it as an interest, not as a profession. Now I started out being a Civil War buff. Actually, I started out being an Irish history buff years ago. For the obvious reason, I think you can recognize why a guy with my name would be an Irish history buff. And then I got interested in the Civil War, and I fought that, and I was very sympathetic with the North. That's a bad way to be if you're a Civil War buff. And then Bruce Catton came along, and there really wasn't any point in being a buff anymore. And then I got interested in the Revolutionary War, and I found out that George Washington won it, and I figured that wasn't too much fun. And then I got interested in the period 1939 and 1940, because I was very concerned with how did we, when I was such a young kid, manage to get ourselves into so much trouble without trying. And you exhaust that subject after a while. And then I got interested as a buck, now not as a professional, in the Russian-American company. And there really ain't no particularly good reason why I should be interested in it. My dissertation was on the Ukraine, which is pretty far from Alaska. But it turned out that a lot of the Russians who traveled around the Ukraine and wrote articles on it were also hired by the Russian government to travel around Siberia and look at Alaska. And so as I was doing research for my dissertation, I wound up reading chapters on Siberia and Russia, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then I got more and more interested in it over the years, because it's a fun period of history. It's one of those weird historical periods that has both a beginning and an end. And the end is very straightforward. We bought the place and they left. And it's that simple. And it had a beginning too. A fellow came over and he found it and he said, I think this is a great place to hunt and trap furs. And they hunted and trapped and did all sorts of strange things. And after all, it is a longer period of history than the Alaska that we all know. Russian historians are very concerned with a thing called periodization. Now, American historians, I'm a buck now, they're very worried about schools. Well, they have all sorts of schools. They have schools for this and schools for that. Now, in geography, we don't have any schools at all. We just one, you know, there's so few of us, we can't afford to have all these great disagreements. But historians do, and they have revisionists, and they have free thinkers and bad thinkers, and I don't know what all they got. The Russian historians don't look that way. They are very concerned with periodization, is what they call it. The Russian-American company is great. You got one period, around from 1741 to approximately 1799, and 1799, Paul I, who was supposed to have been crazy, that's why they shot him. He was accused of being crazy. He said, I'm going to charter the Russian-American company. This is the same year he sent 90,000 Cossacks to invade India. They shot him for trying to invade India. They said, good deal, you took Alaska. And they had 20-year leases. In about 1820, the whole thing got reorganized, and then they reorganized it again in about 1840, and then it came 1861. I didn't know what to do with it, so they thought about it for 6 years, and they met this character, Seward, and he said, you know, I think we'd buy it. And the Russians said, oh boy, take it off our hands, will you please? So it's complete, that's simple. And surprisingly enough, there's a lot of information. Now, I'm a fuck, you see. Historians, they never have enough information. They're terrible people. Boy, you read a historian and he says, you know, I don't have Seward's memo on the morning of October 19th about what he had for breakfast that morning, therefore the record's incomplete. But actually the record's very, very good. The Russians produced a lot of material. and one of the earliest and best. It was published in 1861 as a two-volume book by Tikhonov, which everybody quotes and nobody reads. And it's like most Russian books. They sent some explorers over here, and they wandered around, and they wrote some very good material, which is very well thought of today. Most of the basic ethnography of the Alaskan natives, and I don't really know, like the chairman said, I'm a Chichaco. I'm a native of Seattle, and apparently up here a native is someone who's not exactly born here, raised here. But anyway, the basic ethnography that's used at the University of Alaska comes largely from materials left by Russian explorers, which somebody got around to translating a few years ago. You know, most people don't read Russian, which is unfortunate because it's a very easy language. Also, there's another interesting thing about it. It really played its role in world politics, and it's fun. The Russian-American Company didn't cause any wars, and it didn't cause anybody any trouble. It just sat up here and tried to mind its own business and make money selling furs, and everybody got involved with it. The French, and the Spaniards, and the Americans, and the British, and the Russians, and it's a beautiful capsule example of world history from about 1750 to about 1867. And here you see the impact of the major geopolitical trends of the times, and it's fun to look at. But there's another reason why I'm really interested in the Russian-American Company. Now, you may not believe it to look at me, but I'm 40 years old. I realize I look a lot older, but that's how old I am, and I got papers to prove it. And the people who founded and established and ran the Russian-American Company were a bunch of 40-year-old losers. There were guys who were worthless till they got to be 40 and came to Alaska, and then they amounted to something. And this makes me feel real good, because when I turned 40, I came to Alaska, and maybe there's a lesson in it for me. There's a distinguished bibliography on the subject. And I went to the trouble to make up a list. And if anybody's real wild about me reading it, I'll read it to you. I should read it to you. If you're a professional historian, I'd have to start out and spend the first half hour discussing all the various sources. But actually, there's a fellow named Hector Shevigny. I'm sure you've all heard of him, and he wrote a lot of books about Russian America, and he wrote some real good books. And as a matter of fact, I think he knew what he was talking about. You can say, maybe it wasn't complete, and undoubtedly it wasn't. Maybe Shevigny didn't write great historical scholarship, all of which means you can read it and understand it, and have so many footnotes in it. Well, as a matter of fact, it was a pretty good job. There's another one, The First Real History of Alaska, written by a character named Bancroft, or edited by him. He hired a bunch of people who knew what they were doing, and he got them to write chapters. It's a modern-type study, like a government study. The original author's names were just very carefully deleted, which is the right of the government, and it should have been Bancroft's right, and he exercised it. They wrote a very good history of Russian America. And it's kind of a fundamental book, because everybody who's written a history about Alaska since then just quotes Bancroft, who in turn is quoting some people he hired who went and looked at some archives, which in some cases no longer exist. So it's important. It's interesting. We got two characters here who are never professors and didn't get PhDs, and they're buffs like me, so I feel kind of comfortable in the way. Now, I do claim a little bit of knowledge about Russian history. Now, I have to do that because I've taught it, and I would be insulting to the people who hired me to teach it if I said I really didn't know anything about the subject. It would be a little late in the day. And what I want to talk about, if you permit me, since it's embarrassing for me to talk about Alaska a great deal, having only been here about a year, I can tell you stories, but I think you know more stories than I do, because I heard them from my grandfather, and he looked like one of those guys on the wall up there. He could tell stories too. And I can tell his stories, but I don't have any of my own, and that's dangerous. But I'd like to look at Alaska from the Russian point of view. And you'll have to excuse me if I throw in some geography. but that's my profession and I can't avoid it. Down in Anchorage, if you take the train, that's the only way to go, I think, there's a museum. Not as nice as this museum. It's a prettier building, but it doesn't have the exhibits we have. But in that museum, there is a beautiful wedding gown passed on mother to daughter for several generations. It's made in the town of Kazan. Never get to that museum to take a look at it. Beautiful thing. Brought to Alaska, it was a wedding gown, donated to the museum. And this is no accident. This is a modern type map, and I brought it because I thought you might be able to see it. And this is Kazan, right here. And that's a long way from Alaska. That's where the story starts. And it starts in the year of our Lord, 1552. Now at that time, there was a character who ran this part of the world. You notice how it's surrounded by cities, called Moscow. And his name was John. Ivan, the Russians called him. And he had a problem. He had a whole bunch of enemies up here. And he had a bunch of Tatars down here, and there was another group of Tatars floating around in this part of the world, and they were all out to kill him. Later in his life, he became a paranoid. One of the reasons was so many people were trying to kill him. I took them on one at a time, intelligent way. He built a series of fortified lines on the southern boundaries of the forest here, to whip these guys. And he more or less succeeded. They only burned Moscow a couple of times during his reign, which was quite an achievement for a Russian guy at that time. He picked a war with these people. By and large, they were Swedes. He fought them for his whole life. And the Russians have been fighting in this part of the world. The last time they had a big war up here was ended in September of 1944. They almost had another one in 47, and they threatened another one in 54. So there's a long history of it. This is difficult terrain to fight. Bogs, swamps, lakes, strategic fortifications placed between the rivers and the lakes and on the right places, and it's very tough to fight. So all he could do there was fight continuously. But over here, he found somebody he could lick. These were the Kazan Tatars. They owned this area. They were kind of an offshoot of the great Golden Horde of Genghis Khan. And he went out there and he took them. He found 30,000 Russian prisoners in the fort. And when the battle was over, he liberated the 30,000 Russian prisoners, and there wasn't one single Tatar left. Killed every single one of them. The guy's name later became known as Ivan the Terrible. He was sort of a Henry VIII. And instead of killing wives, he killed his sons instead. May have been in a bad age, I don't know. In geopolitics, we sometimes talk about a strategic hinterland. This was Russia's strategic hinterland. This forested area here. The main line of external communication was north through Archangel to London, of all places, and Ivan the Terrible. This is where he made his cannon. This is where he got his articles for trade. Timber, fur, and honey. Honey was a big item in those days. This was before the Portuguese planted sugar cane on the northeast coast of Brazil and wiped out Russia's honey exports. And when he took Kazan, he opened up this whole area of Russia as a great strategic hinterland. And it was used exactly that way. Oh, I like to talk at the beginning of 1581 when a fellow named Stroganov hired a Cossack named Yermak, and off he went to conquer Siberia. And he did. In 1639, the Russians reached the Pacific Ocean. That's interesting, you know, 1620, the Pilgrims came to Plymouth Rock, huh? I don't know what you were taught. I was always taught the Pilgrims had landed at Alki Point, Plymouth Rock would still be undiscovered. But it happened more or less about the same time. The Russians were interested in fur. They were also interested in seal oil and ivory tusks. And they had a very interesting approach to the problem. They didn't believe in going to all that trouble to go out there and trap this stuff themselves. Not when there were a lot of people who lived up there and who trapped it. Anyway, Cossacks were tough, and they were mean. And they'd go into a village, and they had some guns, and they'd shoot up a lot of people, and then they'd say, look, you don't really want us shooting you, do you? Let's make a deal. First thing we'll do is exchange hostages. We'll give you a couple of slaves we picked up from the other village, and you will give us certain people who will come and spend their lives with us. And they oftentimes married those people. They were not monsters. You will also pay us tribute. And they used the Tatar word, yasak, for tribute. Tribute in furs. You go out, you catch furs, you bring them to us, you give us 10-20% of them. Beyond that, we'll trade with you. And actually, after the initial bloodshed, there were reasonable people. They were not out to liquidate or exterminate or wipe out. There is no word in Russian, a good Indian's a dead Indian. I never said that. A good Tatar is a dead Tatar. That's what they said. But not the people who lived in this part of the world. And they built a whole series of towns exploiting the furs. Why were the furs important? There was one guy who had a real monopoly over this fur business, and that was the Tsar himself. This was private, personal income for the Tsar. And Ivan the Terrible, just like his people who followed him, they needed money just like everybody else. And this was one of the ways they got it. The next great czar was a fellow called Peter the Great. And in his last years, he had an interesting idea. He said, you know, I don't think that Asia and North America are united by a land bridge. And why don't you guys go find out? Now that's pretty easy when you're sitting up here in a new town you just built to tell somebody, why don't you go out there and find out if there's water between the two of them? But that's what Peter did. And then he died. He didn't leave an heir. So his wife followed him. And the boys played their games, played roulette with a chair, and they got rid of the wife, and then they had another woman took over the show, and they had a nutty man, and they got a woman who really knew how to run Russia, Elizabeth the First. And then she died, and they had another nut for a czar, and he had a wife who was kind of skillful, so she had him killed, and she became the empress, and that was Catherine the Great. Now, these women had one distinguishing characteristic in common. They all wished to follow the path, the objective laid out by Peter the Great. They weren't interested in following what Peter wanted to do because they were stupid. They wanted to do it because they had no legitimate claim to the throne. That was the only way they could keep themselves on the throne. The best example was Catherine the Great. A German reject. She couldn't even speak Russian when she came to Germany, and a Lutheran to boot. The Lutherans and Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, don't get along too well. They followed Peter's orders. The first was the Great Northern Expedition, now called the First Northern Expedition. These fellows went up from river mouth to river mouth, and they explored the whole northern coast of Russia,
almost
the whole northern coast of Russia till they ran into the Chukchis up here. And the Chukchis knew how to fight back, and this caused them a few problems. The Russians at that time were not too sure they knew how to sail ships. And they knew really they weren't all that smart, so they had the habit of hiring foreigners. And they got this Dane Barry, you know the story. And he broke his heart and his body, all the materials, all the way across Russia, north, down to the Kamchatka Peninsula, to a place called Petropavlovsk, which he founded. Petropavlovsk means St. Peter and Paul, but it's named after. And it's probably a good name, because right in the middle of St. Petersburg, there's a fort called the Fort of St. Peter and Paul. That's where people went who didn't do what they were told by the Tsar. It's also the one place the Germans were never able to conquer when they besieged Leningrad. A couple of interesting things happened. The first routes were northerly routes, really building on very ancient traditions. You notice how these river systems run. Tributaries cross from Kazan. See? You're almost across, down into the basin of the Ob, up you go, down into the Great River system, boom, and you got three choices now. Look at this one, isn't that a good route? Down here, hop over another river, down like so, and you're almost at the coast. The first great trade routes followed routes just about like that. There were north, there were tiger routes. They were trading routes. The people around them were pretty tough. In the 18th century, the routes moved a little farther south. Obviously, the weather was a little bit milder down here. A little farther south. Still about like so. In the 19th century, and this is the thing that decided the fate of the Russian-American Company. The routes moved all the way south. The reason the Russians stayed in the north was they were afraid of two people. They were afraid of the Chinese, and they were afraid of the Tatars, who were still pretty powerful. But in the middle of the 19th century, they took care of the Tatars once and for all. And they suddenly found out the Chinese were not so much to be feared. And they became vitally interested in this area, the Amur Basin. It led in time to the establishment of Vladivostok. Name means Lord of the East, major Russian Soviet naval base on the continent. It also led to a war with Japan, in which they got locked in a lot of other interests. Now, there was a system behind this fur business. These people really weren't stupid. I had no intention, really, hauling a lot of fur from the Aleutian Islands to St. Petersburg and then selling it to the British. The people they wanted to sell it to were the Chinese. And this is the only place where they could trade with the Chinese, the town of Kiaxa. That's a very important place. You can even see it. It's on the Salenga River system. It's one of the very few passes leading from the Soviet Far East or Eastern Siberia into Mongolia and from thence into China. It's a major invasion route. It's the route used by the Mongols. This was the trading point. The Chinese were big bluff artists. I'm a bluff, I can say that sort of thing. They had the Russians bluff for 100 years if the Chinese could really fight. The Russians believed it. The only place they could trade. Now you got an interesting trading system.
Collect the birds out here. The base of operations for the initial explorations was Petro Pavlo. Fort Baring had to build his own ships out there, which was a bit of a problem. The first people to build modern sailing vessels, the first people to build modern steam vessels on the Pacific Ocean were the Russians. The first modern steam vessel was built in Alaska by the Russians. I don't know how many we built today, but they built them then. But they soon realized that this overland route was a rather awkward thing. So they transferred the major base of operations to Ahoy. In the town of Ahoy, here. Ahoy is an interesting word. It comes from the word ahota, which means to hunt. It's the hunter's town. This is the hunter's sea, the Sea of Ahoy. And it's kind of fun to notice it's a closed sea. It's a Russian sea. They sail on the Kuril Islands, Sakhalin. From Ahoy, overland, to Yakutsk. It's the center of the Yakutsk people. By port. This is a northern people living in a severe environment, one, if you will, as severe as what we are accustomed to in Fairbanks, who have their own horse. Very small, very shaggy, very durable, very frost resistant animal. You can survive with shelter at minus 40 below with no problem. All he needs is good packed snow. He isn't very good in deep snow. He's very good in inside snow. Particularly when he's got a Yakut telling him what to do. He doesn't work so well with a breezer telling him what to do, but with a Yakut, they understand. From there, down the Lena River system, overland a bit, down the Angara, to the town of Irkut. This was where the Russian American Company started. Right here.
There's a character named Shelikov. There's been a lot written about him. Not too many people understand him, but I think I understand him. He's almost buff. I've worked in industry and I've seen promoters, and this guy was a promoter, and he was a good one. Now, the first thing he pulled was he married the right woman. She had money. And she had connections. Now, Baring went out and he discovered these happy islands and died in a very dramatic fashion. And he had this German along with him who in one day made this marvelous botanical collection and writings, which we all read, and he died shortly thereafter. But a few nuts went out there later on and they found there's some pretty good fur seals out there. And you can do the same thing in the Aleutians that we've done every place else. You go out, you find a bunch of natives, you line them up against the wall, you kill quite a few of them, you take some hostages, and then you lay it out. You work for us, everything will be just fine, which is precisely what they did up and down the Aleutian chain. But they were slitting each other's throats at the same time. It was not an economical venture. Shelikov got the bright idea he was going to get a monopoly. Not a bad idea in the Russian at that time. It was bad only in one sense. He had a Russian name. If he'd had a French name or a British name, he would have got the monopoly probably with no trouble at all. But he had a Russian name. And he picked up a son-in-law. The guy's name was Rezanov, which is an interesting name. Razak means to cut. He's the guy whose family cut it. Maybe there were loggers, I don't know.
He began trying this in the 1780s. The first proposal, as far as I know, to Catherine the Great to establish the monopoly is made in the year of our Lord, 1787. And that was a very good year. The Russians had beat the daylights out of the Turks. They had beat the daylights out of the Swedes. The plague was over for a change. Nobody was dying of smallpox or bubonic plague. And Russia pulled off one of the grandest diplomatic tour de force of any nation in all of history. One which is still written up. It still shows up once in a while, even in the movies. Saw it on the Late Late Show the other night. Catherine and her entourage left Leningrad, went through Moscow, went south. You see the main road here. And she toured her new conquest. Saw the new fleet at Crimea. She met the Emperor of Austria. She had all the ambassadors along with her, and it was a beautiful summer. And on the way back, this guy Rezanov, and I don't know how he did it, the story is he was very good friends with her boyfriend at the time. His name was Platon Zubov. And he got to Catherine and he said, you know, I think this would be a good idea, Kathy. And she almost bought it. She almost bought the idea. The thing that stopped them in the 1780s, according to one authority who's a Russian, but he's a modern type Russian, so maybe you shouldn't believe him, I don't know. Some of these modern Russian scholars are kind of suspect. Because he develops this conclusion based on a thorough analysis of Marxism and Engelism, and I don't think Marx and Engels knew very much about Alaska. Anyway, he says that at this time, Russia was deathly afraid of France and of England, allied with Sweden and Turkey. They were afraid. They went ahead with this proposal. They get into trouble with the English in the North Pacific. But Rezanov keeps trying away. He really keeps chewing away at this thing. And Chelikov keeps promoting the deal. And finally, what happens to him is what happens to any good aerospace-type manager. He gets a heart attack and dies at the age of 48. He's one of my non-40-year-old heroes. Catherine dies. Paul becomes Tsar, and he doesn't like Zubov at all. Matter of fact, nobody liked old Zubov. Maybe it was his name. It meant teeth. That's a terrible name, even for a Russian man. Somehow or other, Rezanov made friends with Paul the First. Don't ask me how. In the Russia of that time, that was a real trick. There weren't many people who could get along with Paul to begin with. And nobody who'd gotten along with Zubov ever got along with Paul, except this one character. And he sold him on the idea of a monopoly. And it was kind of a fortuitous event occurred. Now, Russia has always been worried about England. Talking about the 18th and 19th century. But lo and behold, the end of the 18th century, Russia is allied with Turkey, traditional enemy, against England. For what reason? Nobody ever really figured out. The official Russian Navy communiques on this are the strangest things you ever saw. The Black Sea Fleet sails to Constantinople and joins the Turkish fleet to sail in the Mediterranean to fight Turkey's enemies. It would be like sending the 1st Air Cavalry to join the Russians to fight the South Vietnamese, you know. It just didn't go over very well. But Paul pulled this stunt. Since he'd already made an enemy out of the English, it didn't make any difference what he did in the North Pacific. Rezanov, you're a nice guy. Go do your thing and have a monopoly. A few months later, they killed Paul because he was crazy. And Alexander I became Emperor of Russia.
Now, of course, you know, you got the same problem all over again. You got to get your proposal resubmitted. You're hoping for an extension of your contract. Somebody said to Sasha, you know, tell you what we're going to do. We got to have a stockholding company here, and we're going to get free shares. How would you like a lot of free shares in a Russian-American company? And old Alexander said, that sounds great. Got it. I like to read between the lines, but Alexander and a lot of his friends had shares in the Russian American company, and they made money out of the deal. And any time a guy's making money out of the deal, it doesn't take a lot to get him to sign on the dotted line. And Alexander did, and the Russian American company was indeed. There is nothing like it in Russian history. Absolutely nothing. Now, they had companies, all right, but they didn't have companies that administered great big territory. They had some fur trading companies. Most of them, actually, were not only trading companies, but they were like every Soviet trade delegation in the world. They were designed for espionage purposes, and they had a lot of them. They didn't take over a whole territory. Now, Russian America was considered a Russian colony. It was usually referred to as the Russian possessions in America. The Russian America Company was referred to not really as Russian. The word they used was Rossiyskaya. Doesn't that sound pretty? Rossiyskaya. It's a lot better than Ruskaya. Can you hear the difference?
I'm sure you can.
Ruskaya, Rossiyskaya. Pretty, it's got a greater lilt for it. And this was the word they coined in the 18th century to mean not just Russia, but all sorts of other people. We translate it as the Empire of All the Russians. This was their official title in those days. And they used the term Rossiyskaya. A little bit imperial. But the real meaning was, these are not necessarily Russian-speaking people. They're not necessarily Russian. And one of the big wigs was the emperor, just like he was Grand Duke of Finland, just like he was the Grand Duke of the Knights of Malta and all sorts of other strange things. A minor point, maybe. But when it came time to sell the place, they were not selling territory that administratively and politically had been integrated into the Russian Empire, which meant it was easy to get rid of. Now, let me go on with this guy Razanov, because I think he was a corker. He's the administrator. He's the guy back home in St. Petersburg, and he's buying everybody up and selling the furs. And there's only two big fur peddlers in the whole world, the Russian-American Company and the Hudson's Bay Company. And Razanov is just doing great, and he's madly in love, and he has a beautiful wife, and he's just happy as a clam when his wife drops dead. Now, even in those days, there were guys that really loved their wives, and he did. And shook him up, right to the core. Now he's 40 years old. That's a bad age. Let me tell you. Somebody gets a bright idea. Why don't you take a world tour? And he thinks, you know, that'd be fun. And they create a world tour. Now, this is an oversimplification. The Russians decide they're going to sail around the world. Magellan's done it. Everybody else has done it. Why shouldn't they do it? And off he goes. But old Razanov, he's a promoter. They ain't going to sit in that boat just sail around the world. He's going to create a whole new empire while he's at it. Why not? Why sit around and be bored in the cabin drinking vodka all the time? Now, the first thing he figures he's going to do is open Japan to Russian trade. The second thing he's going to do is go see this place he's been administrating and talking about and wheeling and dealing. He's going to a Russian America, and he's going to bring a great big library, and he's going to wine and dine and everything else. And then, for the heck of it, he'll pick up Hawaii in the process and open a great new trading empire. So off he goes. He winds up in Kodiak, and he's just a Paul. The only people there are the old and the sick and the weak. Everybody's down south. And he can't find this other overage character either, because he's out in the Bodarka someplace. That's a two-hole canoe. That's Baron. Now he goes chasing after Baron off, and lo and behold, he's down there fighting a great big war with a bunch of Tlingits. Mazanoff's got a few cannon, and they help out, and this is the founding of Sitka, about 1804. And he finds out some interesting things. Russian America can't feed itself. They gotta get some food from someplace. What do you do when you need something in the modern world, right? You go to California. Hey, why not? So that's what he did. They get set his boat, and off he goes down to San Francisco. And he just sails into harbor. Now, the Spaniards had decided that nobody should sail in their happy harbor. They really didn't want foreigners down. One of their problems, you know, in San Diego was the American whalers knew about this. They come into San Diego Harbor, and Spaniards would say stop, and they fired a cannon. The Spaniards forced to demolish one fort right after another. It was terrible. The Spaniards got tired of rebuilding their forts down there. They didn't like forts. There's an honor, he didn't have any sense. But he comes into the harbor. And this is just a beautiful story. The old man's away. The governor general is out investigating some mistake when Rosanna shows up, and he leaves his punk kid in charge. You know, punk kid, you don't know what to do about it. So he says, well, you're not punk. You agree with Trader. As a matter of fact, we think it would be a good idea. And Papa comes home. And he's got the punk kid. He's got the daughter madly in love with the guy, and he's got the church. They're all lined up with Rosanna. Yeah, we think this is a great guy. Now, what does he do? What does any father do in a situation like that? He says, all right. So, we're trading with the Russians. And that led to the establishment of a place called Fort Ross, just north of San Francisco, as the main supplier of foodstuffs for Russian America. Later on, it became a high-cost food-producing area. Later on, of course, you know, these 40-year-old guys that died off, and the whole thing got reorganized. They got a bunch of smart-aleck, modern-type administrators. And they did their cost effectiveness analysis on the place, and they figured out, you know, it really ain't worthwhile keeping it. So they sold it to a guy named Sutter, who turned around and found gold. And that was the beginning of the California gold rush, right there on the land the Russians sold it. These guys were clever. They really were. Now, Baranoff is what we call a I don't use that word up here, I must be shocked. But they use it down the world I come from, you know, they're illusions. Which is most of them. Now, he was a loser. Nobody really knows where he started from. And it's a very good name, Baranoff. The Baran could be the word for drummer, but it's probably the word for Baron. If that was his real name, I'll eat my hat. I don't know where he got it. He went bankrupt, trained with these people up here. And he winds up down here in Arkansas, he ain't got nothing. Bankrupt 40-year-old cast-off trainer, and he can carry the Shellac off the Shellac off too. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I got this place out there called Kodiak. Back there about 1783, I told me a town up there, and it's a great place, and you'll love it out there, and I need a manager, and would you like to go? The pay is good. Which is IOUs, but, you know, who cares? And then that's it, yes. And off he goes, and gets shipwrecked on the way, which was pretty normal in those days. He spends the winter on an island, starving to death, and he gets in a Bodarka, and he paddles over, and he looks at the town, and he's the governor general. They got an awful lot going for him.
Matter of fact, first thing he finds out, of course, like any good guy who's retired in a job like that, to be the field representative, he found out most everything he was told just wasn't true at all. Now, one of the first things he says is he doesn't like the site, so they moved the site to Precinct Bay. And the other thing he decides to do is make peace with the natives. And here's where he did a smart thing. He married one. I mean, why not? 40 years old, he's a loser in life. Why not marry an Indian person? And he did. He had his first son when he was 50 years old, and he made peace with some of the people down in the Yakutat thing. With the Aleut, he got along real well. He went out in the Bedarkas just like they did. And they know how to handle the Russians, too. You guys got a problem? You ain't feeling so good, right? Raining, cold, and wet. How you want to go to do? Starting at 12 o'clock tonight and ending at 12 o'clock tomorrow, I got me a barrel of spirits over here, and here's a cup that goes through the earth. If you knew how to handle it, and you did not have an alcoholic problem in this camp. The only problem his men had was that he could out drink and out fight every single one of them. That's the end of the problem. Have a boss like that, you know, it's pretty hard to go around. Now, old Shelikoff figures out something. Catherine the Great is very religious. She got religion late in life. Religion, orphans, foundlings, you should have been interested in orphans, including. Shelikoff says, you know, I'm going to get to that woman. I'm going to get my monopoly. So he goes to the Holy Synod, which is the boss man of the Russian church, and he says, I got these great people out there, and they're looking for the word of God, and why don't you send me a bunch of missionaries, and we're going to build some churches. The Russian Orthodox Church was not really very enthusiastic about missionary activities. One of the reasons was most of these guys were married. But by working on the synod and working on Catherine, and Catherine thought this was a great idea, and these guys finally got sent. And of course, Shelikoff, I read, you know, who cares? Sure, there's a great church, and there's a great place for you to live, and there's a marvelous rectory, and there's this, that, and the other thing. And one fine day, Baranov looks up, and a ship comes into harbor, and he says, oh boy, I've run out of vodka. And what you got? A bunch of priests. There were a few minor problems, like there was no church, no rectory, a few other things like that. And there was another problem. These dear happy priests thought that it was real nice if you were going to live with a lady that you get married. And they said to old Baranov, you know, you ought to get married. Matter of fact, all these guys you got here ought to get married. You're all living in sin. Now, Baranov had never been married before. Under the rules of the Russian Orthodox Church, there was absolutely nothing to stop him from getting married. And since that was his one and only wife, and since he did love and adore her and hold to her until death do us part, no reason at all why I shouldn't have married her. And yet he refused. I'm telling you how sharp this guy was. In the first place, it was kind of normal in those days in Russia to, you know, have kind of a common law wedding when the priest showed up and you could afford it. It wasn't cheap to get married. Of course, I realize it's inexpensive today, but it sure wasn't then, not in the Russian church. Priests come around, 5 years, you know, you see the people, 50 and 60 years old, with 12 kids lined up getting married. Now, it wasn't that unusual. But he refused because he didn't want to set a precedent for his men, some of whom had left somebody back home, some of whom couldn't afford it, and some of whom really thought maybe they'd like to go back to Russia and maybe do something else.
This was a big issue. Why did he do it? This guy was a leader. A natural leader who understood his men and their motivations. The results, as far as I can tell, were really rather promising. People did get married and did do rather well together. He had some other stunts he pulled. He found out there was a thing called an American whaler. And the American whalers were floating around up in there. And he couldn't get his goods to China. And you know, this is an awful route. In the first place, I start it, and I catch my furs out here, and I bring them down here, and off we go, overland, down to your goods. Why not just take them to Canton, down here? A Canton is the principal Chinese port for foreign trade. It was then, and it is today. That's where they have their foreign trade there. And they let Americans go there. And they let a few other people go there. And the Americans were just great going there. Hey, find these whalers. The whalers got some food, got some guns, a few other things he needs. Give some furs, and off they go. They sell it in Canton for him. He's making money hand over fist. This is, of course, a complete violation of every regulation the Tsar ever promulgated. It's a complete violation of all the regulations on foreign trade, the Russian Empire, but he makes money, huh? And you got a few interesting things happening. In 1812, we decided to go to war with the English. Now, why we did it, I don't really know. Maybe some of you do. Why anyone would pick on England in 1812 with the military capabilities they had, I've never understood. But we did it. And we had a bunch of ships in the North Pacific, and these guys were pretty smart. They knew any British man of war come along and they would all get sunk. Fair enough, I got the answer to your problem. Boys, I'm going to rent all your ships. Would you do it? Put the Russian-American company flag on her ships, and he says, sail to Canton and sell my furs. And they all became, the whole merchant marine that was in the North Pacific that theoretically was American sailed on the Russian-American company flag. They're pretty sharp at things like that. '18, '19, he's finished. And a whole new ball game starts. And this is known as how to over-administrate an organization.